Hi, guys. This is T.D. Rowan from the Yale Bulldogs, and you're listening to the D-Fly and Dixie podcast on Inside Lacrosse.
Coming to you from the IL Podcast Studio in the Baltimore, Maryland, worldwide headquarters of Inside Lacrosse, it's the D-Fly and Dixie Podcast, featuring Inside Lacrosse, ESPN, and Big Ten Network analyst, and my Blue Jay brother, Mark Dixon. I'm your host, Dan Flynn. Dix, let's get it. So, Dix, I got a couple of questions for you.
Okay.
So, first, how was my sister's eggplant parm?
It was excellent. Yeah. A++. I enjoyed another piece when I got
just
home.
Just one? No. There was some square footage of that.
More than one.
It was a big tray.
My kids really liked it. And my wife. So my wife, remember I told you.
What? I thought you didn't like eggplant, couldn't eat it.
She's allergic. But she's
allergic to? Is she allergic to zucchini and squash?
No. And I wish she was because she makes it a lot. And it's not one of my favorites. But she had a bite. And she was like, this is unbelievable. She goes, thank Dan's sister, blah, blah, blah. I was like, wait a second. She's like, I know. It's just, you know, I could have a little. She had like a little bite, and she said it was excellent. So, well done.
Tracy. Gianfacaro will be happy.
Gianfacaro. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's great.
Way to go, Tracy. Yeah, anytime.
But again, I am going on record as saying I received an entire eggplant parmesan this year, whereas last year I got like just a cube of lasagna. So I'm still
a Tupperware.
We're still investigating where the rest of that lasagna ended up.
Yeah. Well, maybe perhaps there'll be another one coming.
Mm.
She'll be in town in next weekend. So my nephew, her son Michael, is the goalie at Culver.
Okay.
He is playing at Boys Latin and McDonough.
Oh, neat.
The 23rd and 25th. So maybe there can be another meetup, and I can.
Maybe she could be a guest on the podcast.
Oh,
bring her in.
She might like that.
Bring her in.
Her husband will like that.
Yeah.
George, we might have to bring you in studio. But for Trader, like in Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, the show I was telling you about on Amazon Prime, the woman was trying to get her husband into the comedy, like cellar or the comedy show, and she would bribe.
The Ha Ha House?
Should bribe, chuckles, should bribe the booker with brisket, with a fresh brisket that she would cook all day to get her husband on stage. So
I can
Trace,
be bribed.
If you're listening, yeah. George, if you want to get on this podcast, Dixie wants a lasagna. Make it two.
Make it two.
All right. So speaking of the recommendations, one of our listeners, Jesse Brunning, recommended something on Netflix. He was going to check out what we recommended, and he recommended a F1 documentary series called Drive to Survive. So, crazy story. Last night, I come upstairs. My wife was watching something on Netflix, but had fallen asleep, and it was like the closing credits.
That's crazy.
The next thing that popped up was this documentary, Drive to Survive. It's like recommended for me to watch next, which I found
interesting.
A little weird. So,
yeah.
But Jesse, I did watch the beginning of it, and I liked it. I did fall asleep about 5 minutes into it because I was really tired.
Was that more because you were tired or because of the content?
No, it was cool. It was something I'm not really into auto racing,
right?
You know, not that much, but it was very well done. And it starts with this Australian guy from Perth, Australia, who's a famous F1 driver, and how it's his quest to be the best in the world. It starts with him, and the guy was a compelling guy, and it seemed like something I would want to watch. And I'm sure he's just one of the main characters.
One of the many characters running around. Okay. Game. Boys, I have a question for you.
What's up?
So we just sat down to do the podcast, but as I came into the building, put my stuff down in our palatial studio, and then went to use the restroom, you were coming out as I was going in.
Yeah.
And you were drying your hands. What's like the proper etiquette to greet somebody when you're coming into a restroom and someone's coming out? Like, I just pushed you and shoved you and said, let's go.
I basically opened up the door to leave, and we bumped into the doorway.
Literally.
So the proper etiquette is I did wash my hands.
That's the thing. I have no problem with wet hands whatsoever. So I know the hands are clean.
Yeah.
Unless they're wet from something else, which is not typically the case. I mean, that's
a to just pat you on the back. That's that was the case.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Dix is wearing like a sports coat. Oh, just
fist bump.
Here's your blazer.
But no, so when
I
you
think
know
a fist bump is actually the, maybe the appropriate thing.
You think that?
In,
you think
in
so?
The men's room, yeah.
Because I mean, you know, the hands are clean.
Yeah.
If somebody's been washing,
I don't know
if
yours are.
But that's the thing. When you're walking,
you could have
in,
been coming in. You just sneezed, or you
got,
had to wash your hands for something. Maybe
well,
maybe you're changing the oil in your car.
In that regard, I, you know, if somebody tried to shake my hand, I'd be like, oh, hey, man, no, yeah. no, I got germs or whatever. But I just, it's always an interest. It's like a, it's
yeah.
Like,
there's an etiquette.
Can,
there's
can,
a code.
It can be like an uncomfortable exchange, and I don't know why. Like it's not.
No, know, I hear what you're saying.
It's not like somebody has their, you know, has their pants down or anything as they're exiting and entering a restaurant, or maybe entering if there's. If there's an issue.
Yeah. So I just kind of said, hey, I'll see you when you get out of here.
Yeah, that's what
I'll
you
be in
said.
The office.
And I shoved you yeah. into the...
tried to shove me into the sink.
I was like, let's go.
I was like, hey, good to
I
see
you.
I
tried to give you a swirly. So anyway, that just piqued my interest. But yes, go ahead with your next point of discussion.
You were at Rutgers for a game earlier this week, and Lehigh got a nice win, 13-10. Back and forth kind of game. Lehigh pulled away at the end on a great play that kind of started it from one of your favorite players, Craig Chick.
Craig Chick, and this was a game that was sloppy. Momentum was tough to get. No one could really grab a hold of the game. Rutgers seemingly had it up 8-5, and then they were just trying to make a simple exchange pass from the wing down behind the goal, and Craig Chick, I can't remember if he snared it directly out of air or knocked it down, then picked it up, but then he went coast to coast, gave it up to the point man, got it back, and then scored, made it 8-6, and then from there, Lehigh was able to score three straight to make it 8-8. And then the teams traded goals, and when it was 10-10 in the fourth quarter.
You know, about 2-3 minutes left?
Let me say it was about 3.5 minutes left in a game, somewhere around there. Chick just picked Kieran Mullen's pocket. So best player on Lehigh versus probably best player on Rutgers, and just took the ball away from him clean, got it on the carpet, and went the other way. And then Taliaferro, midfielder for Lehigh. I think he ended up with 4 goals in the game. He scored late in that game. I can't remember the order of the goals right off the top of my head, but Taliaferro was terrific. And, you know, for a Lehigh team coming in, terrible shooting, rash of injuries. First goal that Rutgers scored, I believe Ryan Gallagher scored, and he ended up colliding with Eddie Buhal, one of the veterans on the Lehigh defense. Buhal did not come back into the game, so another injury. So for Lehigh to battle through all of that on the road against a Big Ten team and come away with a victory, huge win for the Mountain Hawks. A lot of questions for Rutgers in that game. My biggest question going away is, where's the midfield? Where is the midfield scoring? They scored 13 goals last night. One was scored by a quote-unquote midfielder, Tommy Coyne. Coyne is an attackman playing midfield, and he basically just switched with Gallagher. Gallagher was running some midfield last year and then early this season. Now with Mullins back, Coyne has jumped into the midfield, and Gallagher's playing down low, and Coyne was the only midfield goal that that Rutgers got. So midfield scoring right now and midfield productivity, huge question mark for the Scarlet Knights.
One thing you said on the broadcast, I got to bring up. You said when you were a freshman at Hopkins, you used to play like a 2-on-2 game.
T-ball.
Yeah, explain that.
So T-ball was...
I wasn't clear how you described it.
We would have one person would be the goalie for the entire game. It was typically 3-on-3. I think 3-on-3 was optimal. But one team was defense the whole time, and the other team was offense. And like you're playing a game of pickup basketball, like 2 11-by-1s or something like that. You know, if the defense could get a stop and get a clear, that was a point for them. If the offense, you know, obviously scored a goal, that was a point for them. And then once the defense won, they got to play offense, and then the team coming on would have to play defense. And so it was just a lot of fun. We used to play it. The seniors, when I was a freshman, your Bill Dwans and Seth Tierney's, Brian Volker, Matt Panetta, guys like that.
Those guys became pretty good coaches.
Yeah, yeah, but we loved to play T-ball. It was
so
great.
Why is it called T-ball?
I don't know. Well, you used a tennis ball. So maybe because you used a tennis ball. So you used a tennis ball. And there was etiquette. You couldn't – and goalies wouldn't play goalie. So our goalies at the time, Scott Giardina, Ian Hobbs, they wouldn't play goalie. They would play, you know, an offense or defense position, and one of the field players would jump in and play goalie. But it was
– short sticks?
Everybody had short sticks. Yeah, everybody had short sticks. And there was etiquette. You know, you couldn't wind up and shoot. you know, 90 miles an hour. It was a lot of ball movement, you know, and I think you had to make two or three passes before you could shoot. So it was good.
No handshakes after goals? What kind of etiquette? Was it like fist bumps?
It was like, all right, let's go. And it's harder than you think, because when you're playing defense, especially with a tennis ball, you know, you could catch up to it. You know, you're faster. You can run fast. You know, it was fun. It got physical. It got a little chippy.
Did this game die after the senior class left?
Yes. After those guys graduated, we really didn't continue the tradition of T-ball. It was just one of those things where, as a freshman, especially in the fall, you know, we had fall ball, but fall ball wasn't as comprehensive back then as it is now, I guess. Like, when we had fall practice, it was two or three days a week, but we didn't really do any team functions in between, like on our days off, because I think the restrictions back then were different in terms of the total number of hours that you could do it, organized team activity. So you'd go up to the athletic center after class and you'd like go on the backfield, which is now turf that used to be grass, and you would hope that a T-ball game was going on, or a T-ball game was about to get going, and you just jump in and play T-ball for literally a few hours. And then, you know, you go to dinner and go back and, you know, take care of your academics or whatever. It was fun. It was a lot of fun.
Sounds like it.
I got some texts on that. Guys that remember, they were like, hey, man, great T-ball reference. Great pull.
There you go.
You know, so it was a lot of fun.
So a couple other results from Tuesday's games. Hopkins gets must-win game, win over Mount St. Mary's 11-4. The Mount comes out strong, takes a 2-0 lead.
Your boy Brendan Doyle.
Yeah, had a goal. Brendan, one of our summer interns last year, and he's going to come back and work with us again this summer. So shout out Doyle. And your boys up there at the Mount had some opportunities, though, early to take a bigger lead. And then Hopkins sort of got the footing, started scoring some goals. Ryan Darby had an awesome game, 12 saves. And Joey Epstein is 3 goals, 1 assist. He's the Blue Jays' leading scorer and has really emerged as like their best top offensive threat.
He's definitely playing well, living up to the hype. I didn't get to see the game because I was working at the same time, and I haven't had a chance to watch it back. You said you watched it, right?
I watched a lot of it, yeah. I watched it as much as I could, and then I knew you had a game, and then it got really sloppy late in the game, like really bad. Mm-hmm. I think Hopkins was up 10-4, 11-4, and I just couldn't watch it anymore. Mm-hmm. Chippy, sloppy, and you had a really good, interesting, close game, so I switched over to the Big Ten Network.
Wow, thank watched you. Yeah. Look at you. I would have liked to have you in the beginning, but you know, I know how you roll.
Yeah, gotta watch my favorite team.
That's true. And then you were watching Notre Dame football and Duke basketball and all the other front running teams that you cheer for.
Another game that I was checking out though was Duke playing Utah, which we thought could be a blowout. Utah was winning 7-6, like in the second quarter of this game. Really, really impressive performance for Utah. Duke ends up getting a 17-11 win, but I think Utah still would have covered the spread. Robertson and Smith each had 5 points for Duke. They've emerged as their top leading scorers, and they get the job done, but Utah really impressive. So, and then one more, Marquette 17, Robert Morris 15. Another interesting result from Tuesday. And Dix, it leads me into my next part. I want to talk about mid-March surprises and disappointments. As we get to, this will be the third weekend of games in March. And I put Robert Morris, they're now 1-5. They started the season ranked number 18 in the face-off yearbook. Their only win is over Bellarmine and had what I'd consider a bit of a puzzling 12-8 loss to Canisius. They were one of the teams I would put on my disappointment list. Other teams I have on this is Bryant, which was number 25 in the face-off yearbook preseason poll. They're 2-5 with losses to Manhattan, Stony Brook, and Fairfield. And then maybe a third team would be Vermont. Vermont was also, I think, a top 25 team. They may have been like 24 in our face-off yearbook, and which would have put them favored in every game that they've played. And they're only 3-3. And their losses to Navy, BU, and Hobart were all by 5-plus goals.
Interesting. Robert Morris graduated a ton from a year ago, the NCAA tournament team. Defense in particular is what they were hit very, very hard. But they also lost, I think they had one returner on offense come back. A lot of times these preseason rankings, lacrosse tends to be lazy. I shouldn't just pick on lacrosse because it could also be other sports. But oftentimes we just, like, the number one team is always the returning champion. I think we become much better at this. Lacrosse magazine used to be the laziest of the lazy. I remember when Virginia won the national title in 2003. And then you look at what they were losing coming back, and they were ranked number one in preseason. Like, what? Like, they lost Rotelli. They lost a bunch of other guys. Now, they had some really, really good young freshmen on that team that turned out to be studs by the time they were seniors. And even before then, Matt Ward, Kyle Dixon, Michael Culver, and that 2006 Virginia team was dominant as an NCAA champion as you're going to see. But, you know, like putting them number one in 04, I'll just never forget that.
Right.
And they I don't think they made the tournament in 04. It's gotten a lot better since then, but I think that we're guilty of taking the prior year's body of work and then trying to extrapolate it into the next season, not accounting for leadership, hustle, just intangibles that we might not be as familiar with. So I hear what you're saying about Robert Morris. You would hope that they would follow up an NCAA tournament berth and a NEC championship with something more, and they're not. Vermont loses Ian McKay. Huge loss for the Catamounts, and they're still trying to figure some things out. What do Robert Morris and Vermont have in common, though, coming into 2019? Two of the best goaltenders in the game, Wishuda for Vermont and Hager for Robert Morris. So, you know, even with those much highly touted goaltenders, they're really, really struggling. Who was the third team? Bryant. Another Northeast Conference team. Not super familiar with Bryant, but that's a team that year in and year out plays an aggressive out-of-conference schedule. And not that Robert Morris and Vermont do not, but they always seem to be battle-tested and ready for conference play and then that conference tournament as well. Honestly, and this is going to sound horrible, the thing that I'm most familiar with Vermont is those ridiculous uniforms that are like skin tight. Still can't figure that one out. But I haven't followed Vermont a whole lot this year, so I don't have a ton of opinion on the Bulldogs.
All right, so here are my surprises. Some of them are pretty obvious. So number five, Towson, currently ranked number five.
Sure.
5-1, was number one in the country ranked last week. They were number 26 in our face-off yearbooks, and we mentioned this last week, but I don't know if there's been a team that's been far out of the top 20 who rose to number one so quickly, or if ever. And number 10, High Point. So High Point, 6-1. They have great wins over Duke and Virginia. They keep plugging along, winning games. They were ranked number 38 in our face-off yearbook.
Hmm.
And they've proven themselves to be a deserving top 10 team.
Yep.
And should stay there all season long.
If
they stay healthy and keep winning the games that they are capable of winning, or at least they seem to have the talent to win. And then another surprise, we mentioned them earlier, is Utah. You know, four wins already in early March, mid-March, and for a brand-new program who was ranked number 73 in our face-off yearbook. Terry and Quint mentioned this, that we always rank the new programs at the end.
Well, you have to. They don't have a button. They don't have anything as a comparator.
But still, very impressive. And their sophomore attackman, Josh Dowd, 28 goals.
That's impressive.
On the season. And so hats off to the Utes.
Speaking of Vermont, you know, that's the only game they haven't been competitive in. Was their inaugural game in the program's history, losing 21-6 to Vermont. But this is a ball club that had a three-game win streak, winning three one-goal games in a row, Air Force, Furman, and Bellarmine. And then they, you know, they got Duke. You know, they kind of got Duke's attention. So I think, yeah, absolutely, Utah to have four wins and the success they've had so far is a credit to Brian Holman and his staff. Towson, what else can you say about the Tigers? It's weird that Cornell would get blitzed on a Friday night. And then you're thinking about, okay, they got to play Towson now, a team that's very efficient offensively and faces off really, really well. Two of the things that were exposed in the we already knew about it going into the Crown Classic or Crown, whatever that was, the Crown Lacrosse event. But it was punctuated by Gerard Arcieri just, you know, dominating at the faceoff dot. And then Grant Ament was just picking that Cornell defense apart, you know, like it was child's play. And then they come back 2 days later and knock off Towson, a team that not as potent as Penn State offensively, but you still have the dominant faceoff man. You still have really good shooters. You still have guys that can light up a score sheet, but I'm with you 100%. Towson last year had a lot of new pieces coming off of that monumental semifinal run championship weekend, and it just never clicked for them last year. It just never worked, so to speak. And your last team, oh, High Point, yeah. I mean, geez, wins over Duke and Virginia already in this season. Asher Nolting is a first-team All-American candidate. Tim Troutner, first-team All-American candidate. Really, really solid bunch down there. In my disappointments, I probably would throw Rutgers in that batch, just after having watched them twice now live. You lose to Loyola and Pat Spencer, and Pat Spencer put on a show that day, and that was a game that they were playing without Kieran Mullins. So I'm willing to give that one a little bit of a mulligan, but the game against Lehigh this week, what stands out to me is the lack of midfield productivity for the Rutgers Scarlet Knights, and this is a team that welcomes back Casey Rose, who's a four-year performer on that team, and he just hasn't done anything. And I think he's capable of so much more. They're just not getting any productivity out of their midfield. How about another surprise? Are there any other surprises that you can think of? I know there's somebody out there screaming
Hobart,
a team's name. Hobart's got one loss. Some numbers.
I think they're 5-1, and have played a decent schedule. And they're going to get into their conference soon.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not some big names out there that they have a good chance to put up a really gaudy record this season.
Okay. Well, good pull. Yeah. Good pull.
All right, Dix, let's get on to the previews for the week ahead. There's some really good games this weekend. One game we're not going to talk about in detail is number 7 Notre Dame at number 12 Virginia. We've covered those teams quite a bit. That's going to fall into our don't miss games.
Yeah.
So we're going to have 3 featured games and 1 marquee game this week. Our first featured game is number 15 Rutgers. Did their game the other day. They're 4-3 now. They really need a good win, non-conference. They're playing in the dome at number 13 Syracuse, who's 3-2, coming off a nice win over Hopkins Saturday at 1:00.
I just hit on Rutgers a little bit. Max Edelman is a guy that's been carrying them, and he was good against Lehigh. He wasn't great, and he needs to be great for them, and he has been. He had 18 saves against Princeton in a win last weekend. That really was the difference in that contest. Again, they need more midfield productivity. They can't continue to just rely on Mullins, Sherlin Beattie's, Gallagher, et cetera. Defensively, I think they have some issues, but I think their close defense is playing okay. I think their short stick D middies, they got worked against Lehigh, so they needed to clean that up. And Syracuse, so I remember, if you recall, the Colgate game, and I said at no point did I ever think Syracuse was going to win that game. There never was that feeling that you get that they were going to go on that run. That feeling was there on Saturday. Hopkins led that game for the most part. Syracuse made a run in the third quarter I think they made it 10-9, 10-10, if I'm not mistaken. It was somewhere in that. I don't remember the exact box score.
I think Hopkins was maybe winning like 8-6 at halftime.
Right.
They tied it up.
It was a slow third quarter.
Then Hopkins finally scored and made it 9-8, and then they went on a run.
Yeah, and you could just sense that it was coming. You could see the energy on their sideline, the fans. I watched it after the fact later on Saturday, so I was staying away from social media. Had a couple conversations with friends. They're like, hey, you want to know the score? I'm like, no, they knew what I was doing.
That's hard to do.
I love the way that Hopkins started the game out, but especially in that third quarter, I'm like, oh, here it comes. Here it comes. And sure enough, it just seemed like the Blue Jays didn't even have the ball in the fourth quarter. So hats off to Syracuse. This homestand, when is it going to end? I mean, this will be the fifth, sixth game in a row Syracuse has had.
It's like Jim Boeheim made this schedule for the Cuse.
Yeah, so I like the way that they're playing right now. And I think they're playing tough. I think they're playing physical. Brett Kennedy in the midfield, the long stick midi, was integral in the game against Johns Hopkins. His energy and toughness made a couple great plays. So this will be a really, really good game. They resume this series. And this is credit to Rutgers. They've really beefed their schedule up over the last couple of years. Second year in a row they've played Syracuse. They added Loyola this year. This was the second year that they played Lehigh. So they're really trying to beef that schedule up. And Rutgers beat the Orange last year in Piscataway. So look to do the same this weekend in the Dome. They're just going to have to really pull it together.
Next featured game is number 11 Denver, coming off of a loss plays at number 9, Ohio State, the lone undefeated team left in the nation at 6-0, Saturday at 1 o'clock.
Who'd have thought that 6 weeks in, Ohio State would be the last team standing? But it's uncanny. And we're only not even at the midpoint of the season. But isn't it uncanny how it works out that the odd number of years Ohio State is really, really good?
Yeah.
2015 NCAA quarterfinalist, 2017 national finalist. Who knows where 2019 is going to take this ball club? But they've been efficient. Last three games, win over Bucknell 16-13, Marquette 13-9, and then on the road at Hofstra 14-8. And the game against Marquette was a neutral site game in Dallas at SMU. So Ohio State has been really good so far this year, and this is where business picks up. Denver comes to town, then they get a shot at Notre Dame, and you know this is an Ohio State team that 2 years ago in Columbus dominated the Pioneers, and Denver, they just dropped the game last week to
Notre Dame,
and I think offensively they're not really clicking like we thought they would, but I think it's an adjustment. I thought they looked very good against North Carolina with the return of Austin French. But Notre Dame defensively can make you look pedestrian. And I thought that they made Denver look a little bit out of sorts in California last weekend. The other big adjustment that the Pioneers have had to make is the loss of Dylan Johnson, the defender.
That's a big one.
I mean, him and Dylan Gaines, the two Dylans down low, fantastic defenders. And I think Alex Reddy's been playing fairly well. He played well against North Carolina. But losing Dylan Johnson is a huge adjustment. So big game for Ohio State. Can they make it 7-0 or is Denver going to go into Columbus and steal one and get a big dub?
So that'll be number 11 Denver at number 9 Ohio State. We had a chance to talk to head coach Nick Myers from the Buckeyes, and here's that conversation.
Welcome into the D-Fly Dixie podcast. We are happy to be joined by Ohio State head coach Nick Myers. Coach, thanks so much for joining us. And you guys so far off to a terrific start, the last undefeated team in Division I. What has gone well so far for Ohio State lacrosse to get to this point of that 6-0 record?
Well, first, just thanks for having me on. I'm grateful for the opportunity. You know, I think I'll have to start with just, you know, credit to the staff. You know, I think I'm really, really fortunate to have great leadership. You know, Brad Ross, our associate head coach in year 5, and Travis Crane, year 3, Andrew Vossler, in his first season with us, you know, working with the faceoffs and goalies. In addition to them, I feel like we're getting great leadership. A little different this year. We've captain. Dave done a really nice job along with some of the veteran guys. And, you know, we understand that, you know, tough times ahead. But so far, you know, been able to navigate this process, you know, as well as we had hoped. And at the same time, feel like there's a lot of room for improvement.
Sure. And I know as you're looking ahead to this weekend's game against Denver, I was hoping that we could rewind a little bit, take us back to last year, Selection Sunday, when the NCAA tournament field was announced. Ohio State was not included. Is that kind of where the new season started for you guys? And you know, ask them maybe the returners to bottle that up. Remember what this feels like? And has that been in any part a rallying cry or any type of, you know, let's put that behind us, but remember it and let's never feel this way again?
Yeah, I appreciate you taking me back to that, Mark. That's, I think it was really hard. You know, we just felt like it was a little too late. You know, we had a really slow start. You know, that Penn State game was probably the low point for us in the season. But we rallied. You know, we had a couple of injuries in that stretch. We got healthy and started to find a rhythm, you know, and beating Maryland, you know, the number one team in the country at home, beating Rutgers, you know, beating the team up north, you know, finding a real rhythm down that stretch there. For us, we felt like, you know, we were in a great position and just unfortunately came up a play short versus a good Hopkins team. And probably a game, if we win, you know, we're back in. And so, yeah, that was really hard. And we lost some really special seniors, defense that we felt like, at least in the 10 years I've been coaching, is good. It felt unfinished. And, you know, yeah, it took a little bit of time to heal from that. And so, but you do. You fall and just kind of attack it as you would any year. You know, it's a new year with new faces, new freshmen, new leaders. But these men are hungry. You know, they understood the schedule was tough. I mean, I think – people can say what they want about our schedule, but, you know, going to Long Island, a place we'd never won before, going to UMass in February, going down to Texas, I do feel like our men have been challenged in a number of different ways. A very good BU team here at home. So we face some tough challenges, and we understand there's going to be more that lie ahead.
And you mentioned the schedule and the challenges. What positives have you taken out and learned from going into UMass in February, winning that game, going to SMU, knocking off a tough Marquette team, and then going to Long Island, a place where Ohio State has traditionally struggled? What are some of those real positives that you have pulled from those victories?
Yeah, I mean, we're making Buckeye history, like you said. So, you know, I think, you know, to be able to kind of accomplish some things that, that teams of the past and some really good teams of the past haven't been able to do, is it does give your men confidence. You know, we put the schedule together, and again, you added four from a year ago, a UMass who, you know, wire to wire with Yale. You know, we really look at this non-conference slate, especially the early non-conference slate, a team in BU with Gray and Burr and some of their weapons. And really knew that, that every week, you know, a Marquette team that beat us a year ago. So, you know, I think we felt like there was a lot in front of us in those early games. And we've just had a one week at a time kind of mentality. You know, we did not win a scrimmage in the fall or spring. So I can certainly admit to that. You know, so this is a team that, that took some lumps in terms of the exhibitions. But I felt like we really challenged ourselves playing at Carolina, playing at Duke. And by doing so, for what was to come, and there's a lot of unfinished business still with this team. You know, we got a long way to go. We've had a good week so far, and our focus right now is just entirely on this challenge we have here at home versus a great Denver team.
Sure. You mentioned some of the faces that you said goodbye to, and a lot of those guys on defense. How would you best describe your defense so far here in 2019, and how they've come together as a unit?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. You know, I think defensively, again, Coach Crane, our defensive coordinator, has done an outstanding job of organizing them. You look at the veterans first, you know, Matt Borges is really kind of the mainstay. He's been in down there for 3 years. This is his fourth year starting for us. Jeff Hendrick had made the move as a junior down to the close D from long committee. So he's playing a new position, but he's doing a great job. He's getting better every week. And then obviously, Franco, you have two short sticks that have a lot of experience. So that's where we built out from. We got two new faces at the long stick mini position, and Evan Riss and Caleb Mahoney. Both are really starting to come on and get more confidence. And Joey Salisbury, a junior, who's done a really nice job this far in the season, and kind of that third D spot for us, who also is getting better. And when you get good goalie play, and Josh is really settled in, I think he's had some strong games so far, and I know he feels like his best stuff's still out there. That helps, as well as, you know, good play at the faceoff X. You limit possessions. So, you know, we're a work in progress, no doubt, but I feel like it's a unit that's starting to really start to build chemistry with one another. The new faces now are starting to feel like veteran guys because they've got six games under their belt, and, you know, we're chipping away at it.
And offensively, you guys have scored double digits in every game, all six of your victories, all six of your games so far this season. What do people need to know about this Ohio State offense?
I'm not sure they need to know anything other than we're just out there trying to do our job. You know, I think offensively, again, I'd start with Brad Ross. You know, he does an outstanding job. I'm very fortunate, you know, to have him here. And, you know, I think he does such a good job with the men of bringing clarity to, you know, exactly what's expected and then keeping it simple. You know, I think we've done a really good job at that end of the field of kind of adjusting to the strengths of our pieces. We've got some new additions that have really helped and kind of, in my opinion, complemented some guys that we already had. So, you know, with that being said, it's a pretty balanced group. You know, I've been really happy with the fact that we're running two midfields. We're playing seven or eight guys in the midfield every week that are doing a really good job. So we're getting good depth there. The attack, I think, like I said, you got kind of an interesting group. You know, you have Trey LeClaire, who's been a little bit of a mainstay down that end of the field for us in year three. But Jackson Reed in his second year, Jack Myers has been outstanding.
Talking once again with Ohio State head coach Nick Myers here on the Dixie of D-Fly podcast. And you just mentioned Jack Myers, coach, a guy who's a freshman who's provided a real spark. What about him has helped him fit into Columbus so easily?
Yeah, he's been amazing, you know, in terms of just the fit. You know, I think we got a really good freshman class. It's a close group. And Jack's certainly a big part of it. You know, he was a late addition to the class, but I think from day one has really acclimated to Buckeye lacrosse. Special young man. He's done an outstanding job in the classroom. You know, and I think as far as his play on the field, you know, he's got great instincts. He sees the field. He's strong with the ball. You know, he's really developing as a scorer. Had a big goal last week versus Hofstra. You know, and I think his vision and his feel for the game is pretty special. You know, so as I said, he's a guy that is not just a scorer, if you will. He's really making people around him better. And so that's been exciting. You know, I think he's just scratching the surface. He's getting more and more confidence every week. And so are the guys playing around him.
We turn our attention now, as you have all week, to the Denver Pioneers, a team that comes in on paper, yes, maybe your toughest opponent. What do you see when you look at Denver, and what are some of the things that have to go well this weekend for Ohio State to beat a team like Denver?
Yeah. We always say around here the toughest opponent is us. You know, so I think that, first of all, you want to make sure you don't beat yourself. And so I think for us, every week starts that way. And we've really evaluated ourselves coming off Hofstra. We felt like there was a number of things that we really need to take a hard look at to improve. And so that's what we've been hammering away at. But as you said, then you dive into a team that presents a number of challenges, as they always do. In Denver, Ohio State, it's a tradition that, you know, ever since I've been out here since 2001, we've played every year. It's a great game. We always get their best, and they certainly force you to rise to the occasion. So I think when you look at their face-off and wing play right off the bat, they got a young man, you know, now that obviously is different than who they've had there, but is doing a really nice job. You know, number 19, number 20, they got great wing play. So I think you look at their rope, and that's certainly one of the first things you have to address. They got a veteran goalie, a very well-coached defense that knows exactly who they are. And offensively, they got one of the best shooters in college across, with some excellent pieces around him. So, you know, with four back in the lineup, you got a real quarterback feeder now and several midfielders that present a number of challenges, as well as one of the best stretch shooters in college across in 10. So, you know, it is a lot to think about. You know, for us, we got to make sure we take care of our side first and just have a great week of preparation.
And changing gears a little bit, you've been the head coach for the USA Under-19 team before in 2016. You won the gold medal. You'll do it again in 2020. How does that experience help you as a coach and a leader?
No, I appreciate the question. Yeah, I'm really excited about this opportunity. As far as how it helps me as a leader, I would say that anytime you have an opportunity to kind of get outside your bubble, if you will. I mean, I've been very fortunate. This is my 16th season out of 18 coaching to be in one place. And Ohio State has done so much for me as just a professional, as a young man. And I've really grown up in this athletic department. And I give credit to a lot of the people that I've leaned on to help me with that and continue to. The USA experience was amazing because I got outside to work with some different people and to work with US lacrosse, to work with coaches like my brother, Peter Toner. You know, it was amazing. And you look at the guys like, you know, Bill Leahy, he's a Hall of Fame coach, Chuck Rubling, John Jez, you know, that experience of working with amazing professionals, as well as an incredible group of young men from different places. You had some other state schools, ACCs, Ivy Leagues, you name it. And that was just an awesome experience. So I think that would be the takeaway that I had in the first go around, and certainly hoping, although I'm sure it will be different, to have a similar experience in 2020.
And your program, Ohio State, you've incorporated a lot of box lacrosse into your training, especially the off-season routine. Why have you been such a proponent of that, and what have been the key takeaways that help the Buckeyes?
Yeah, I appreciate you mentioning that. You know, I'm a huge believer in box. I love to see the influence that's starting to really come over the United States. It seems like it's growing every year. And, you know, I'm one that has an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old at home, two boys, and I coach their box team all winter. You know, so I'm a big proponent of box at the 5-6-year-old level all the way through the college developmental level. You know, I think the number of touches, I think what it can do for your game in terms of the understanding of the speed, the small spaces, the pick play, the feet and fists, the finishing, the throwing the ball hard, the cardiovascular challenges, and the toughness. You know, there's so much. So that's what we could do a full podcast just on that. You know, in a nutshell, that's how I feel. But I'm a big believer that box is a huge positive for any young man, you know, whether, like I said, you're 5 years old or 25 years old.
We're always looking for content here at Inside Lacrosse Coach, so we might take you up on that at Box Lacrosse Podcast one of these days.
Right on.
Last question for you, and this is from Dan Flynn, my esteemed co-host. Who is the best lacrosse player ever from the state of Maine?
Oh.
That's exactly how we thought you were going to answer the question.
I would say, you understand, I grew up, my stepfather, Charlie Birch, who's the head coach at UNE now, I mean, he rattled off, I don't know the exact number, you'd have to look, but I mean, he rattled off like 10 or 11 state championships in a row with Cape Elizabeth. So when I was a young man growing up, and my brother and I used to ride the bus to all those state championships, and the Capers, man, they were unbelievable. I mean, they were like heroes to my brother and I. So, I mean, you look at Brendan Biggis, Matt Williams, Eric Krunkela. I mean, these are guys those guys were stars to Pat and I. And those were kids, those guys all went on to play big time college across at great places. And Matt Williams was an amazing player at Colby. Krunkela was the guy that went to Springfield, who I followed there. Biggis went to Franklin and Marshall. So I would say any of those star players from some of those Cape Elizabeth teams, they were so dominant for so long in the state of Maine. It was them and then everybody else. And my stepfather was who introduced me to the game. So I really looked up to not only him, but also to those guys that played for Cape.
Excellent. And we also knew you were going to rattle off a bunch of names because we know that there's guys that have come out that can play ball.
Yeah, I'm sure I left some out. So I'm going to get some stuff for that from somebody back home.
Excellent. Well, Coach, Nick Myers from the Ohio State Buckeyes, thank you so much for joining us. Best of luck this week against Denver and throughout the rest of the season.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Take care.
This is definitely the toughest test that Ohio State has seen yet this year. And you mentioned their schedule really picks up as they are about to head into the Big Ten season. But what about Denver's schedule? Now, I know that their geographic location makes the travel like a must, but they have played at Duke and at North Carolina in different weeks.
So and both an 11 a.m. start time and a 10 a.m. start time.
Yeah, they were out in California last week.
Yeah.
Now they're coming out. They'll play at Ohio State. They'll go back home. Then they'll come out. I guess it's their spring break because they'll play Towson and at Princeton the 23rd and the 26th. That's a killer. That's a lot of travel.
It is. That is by design in a lot of ways. Like Bill Tierney is preparing this team on a couple different levels. One, by playing this type of schedule, you think the numbers are going to be there for the criteria for NCAA at-large selection, which Denver has benefited from a couple times.
Several times in the last few years.
Exactly. Strength of schedule is going to be there. Quality wins could be there. You know, beating North Carolina. If the Tar Heels are one of those teams sniffing around at the end of the season for an at-large berth, Denver owns the head-to-head. And also, it's just you get your team ready for the conference play. They're in the Big East. And they're the most westernmost school playing lacrosse outside of Utah. Yeah. So that's a lot of travel that they have to endure. And I think Bill Tierney does a great job of just getting his guys ready to rock and roll.
So Dix, our last featured game, number 5 Towson is 5-1. They'll travel to Tobacco Road to face number 2 Duke, now 7-1 in Koskinen Stadium Saturday at 1:00.
Duke, a team that is starting to roll. You know, the early season loss to High Point, and then you had the close win against Denver, shellacked Penn, humdrum, ding-dong kind of win against Richmond, hard-working win. But the Loyola victory is the one, I think, that let people know that Duke is for real, for real, for real. Great defensive effort. Nakai Montgomery, having him back in the lineup makes them different, makes them much more difficult to defend. They're facing off pretty well. They're getting decent goaltending. Not exactly the formula that a team like Towson that took their first L on last Sunday against a Cornell team that seemingly was licking its wounds big time after getting blitzed by Penn State. But that's why they play the games. And this is why you strap it on and you just go out and you see what's going to happen. So, I'm looking forward to this game. Obviously, Woodall at the faceoff dot is going to have the advantage. Defensively, I think Duke matches up very, very well with Towson. Zach Goodrich is a guy who probably – who's he going to cover? Are they going to maybe put him on Montgomery? Do they have the confidence to put him on Montgomery? Or is a poll going to get Nakai Montgomery? We'll wait and see. But a lot of interesting matchups all over the field. Kobe Smith, do they unleash him in the middle of the field, or do they keep him back playing close? And, we saw against Loyola, he wasn't as free-ranging in that game with the assignment of Pat Spencer. Is he the guy that's going to get Brad Smith? And then if he does get that matchup, is he less inclined to push the tempo and get involved in transition? So a lot of different storylines in this one.
On to our marquee game of the week, number 3, Cornell. 4-1 now, travels to Yale for the Ivy League opener for both teams. Yale's number 4-3-1. That game is Saturday at 1 o'clock. It'll be aired on ESPN News.
ESPN News?
ESPN News. That's okay. What I have in my notes here.
Gotcha. Yale got votes for number one this week, and I don't have a problem with that. They beat Penn State head-to-head, and but hey, we're talking here middle of March. Rankings don't mean squat, but this is a good team, and beating UMass in overtime. UMass is a team that gave them the most fits in last year's NCAA tournament, so let's not forget about that. I think people were dogging Yale for struggling, quote-unquote, with UMass. But remember, UMass gave them the best test on their way to a national championship a year ago. And then they took care of Michigan in Atlanta, another neutral site game from last weekend. And now they get the Big Red. And last year in the Ivy League championship game, Andy Shea and the Yale staff were chastised for not shutting off Jeff Teat. I didn't have a problem with them not shutting him off. Quite honestly, when you shut off one of the game's most electric players, I think you steal from the fans. I think you take away an element of the game. But we've seen some development from other Cornell players to where Teat's really not getting face guarded a whole lot in 2019. So I think that's great. Just because you get to see his creativity, you get to see him involved in the game. Again, face-offs for Cornell. You're going up against the best in the business, T.D. Erland. That's going to be a major problem for Cornell. And the goaltending, and this is brother against brother. So T.D. Erland for Yale, Chase Erland got the nod last weekend and got the win against Towson. So it looks like he might be the guy moving forward for the Big Red. Great game on tap. You know, really always good when Cornell and Yale get together and duke it out.
So I had a chance to sit down with T.D. Erland and talk about the game coming up.
One of our biggest fans, by the way. And he's very, very vocal about it.
And one of our favorite players. But I got to talk to him about the game coming up this weekend, as well as playing against his brother. So here's that conversation.
We're joined by Yale's All-American Face-Off Specialist, T.D. Erland. T.D., welcome into the D-Fly and Dixie podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, there's a rumor going around that this may be your favorite podcast in inside lacrosse. Is this true?
The rumors are true. Many reasons. The name's probably the catchiest, but that amongst many, this is my favorite inside lacrosse podcast.
Thank you for saying that. This is very kind of you. So, Yale Bulldogs, you've won three straight since falling by a single goal in overtime in the season opener against Villanova. Including those wins have been over Penn State, who's now ranked number one, UMass, and Michigan. So how does your team rebound from that for opening game loss, and what's been the keys to your success over the last three games?
Yeah, I think the first game was just kind of a wake-up call to us. Our scrimmages went pretty well, had a pretty good fall, and we thought we were in a good spot, and we just kind of got away from what makes us us. Villanova out-hustled us. I'm pretty sure they out-ground-balled us in the game pretty bad. And we just kind of take a look and get back that blue-collar mindset and kind of focus on taking our attention away from – we always were kind of hunted, it seemed like. And we kind of put that unneeded pressure on ourselves and kind of shifted to trying to be the hunter again. And I think it really helped us against Penn State especially. And then UMass is a really gritty team. They play super tough. And then, obviously, it kept it going through Michigan. So we're just trying to keep the same as we play Cornell.
You've been really dominant, winning 76% of your face-offs. In high school, you were a standout wrestler. And it seems to make sense for Fogo that there's some overlap there. So what did you take from wrestling that helps you on the lacrosse field?
Being so low to the ground, a lot of people are uncomfortable down there. But I feel super comfortable. And I don't know, I think just being in really weird and different positions is like the main thing that helped me. I think just wrestling, just putting me in all those different positions again has helped me a lot.
Hey, I bet you spend a lot of time off to the side with the other face-off guys. Freshman Joe Newman, you probably have formed a nice bond with him. He was 9-for-9 against Michigan, so he's 100% on the season. Are you worried about him taking your starting spot?
I mean, I don't know. Every day he comes and pushes me in practice, and he came up and said something to me after. He's like, well, I hope you know I now lead the country in face-off percentage.
He does.
And all my teammates were busting me on it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm shaking in my boots right now, but it's good. Joe's a great competitor, and he's done an unbelievable job of improving. He's even talked about me all the time. He was been dominant forever and 80 plus percent, I think 85, maybe mm-hmm. in high school in a really good league. And I just, I'm trying to teach him everything I know, and he's done a great job of listening and learning. And he's really helped me too. He's shown me a lot of things that really I didn't know. And it's great to have him on the team. And I'm just super thankful that I get to go with him every single day.
A little bit more of a serious question here. What's been the biggest adjustment you've had to make since transferring to Yale, both on and off the field?
The biggest adjustment off the field, it seems pretty simple, but I think school, I mean, Yale is a really tough school academically. So just kind of having to spend a little bit more time on academics than I did at Albany. I would say that's probably the biggest part, getting along with the guys and meshing with them. At this point, it feels like I've been here the whole time, and we spend the whole day together. So socially, they've made it really easy for me. I mean, John Danangelis, Sam Slotty, Jack DeMoral, Jack Pye, just to name a few. But they've really taken me under their wing and helped me a lot. And feels like I've been here for years now. So I'd say academics has probably been the hardest thing. And then on the field, I think just getting used to the with new wings and just building up a chemistry. I think that always helps and takes time. I think starting to figure it out more. If we watch our fall games, I think we tend to struggle, both me and the wings, just kind of getting to figure out where each other would be. But I think at this point we're starting to figure it out and getting into the groove a little bit.
So as you get ready to play your first Ivy League game against Cornell, what do you expect from the Big Red based on what you've seen on film, and what will be the keys for Yale to win the game?
Yeah, they're a really talented team. I think they're averaging 15 plus goals a game, and obviously Jeff T, Clark Peterson, McCullough, they're loaded top to bottom offensively, and I mean defensively too. They 17-11, I can't remember off the top of my head, but they beat Towson pretty handily, and the defense stepped up big for them there. So we've really got to come and, I mean, just kind of stick to who we are. In between the lines, we got to play them tough, and we're really good everywhere. So me and the whole team just kind of got to go out there and do our job, play smart, and try to not let them get any momentum, because they can light up the scoreboard real quick.
Would you say there's one or two influential coaches or people in your lacrosse career that have really helped you, or is there a particular player that you look up to?
I think coaching-wise, I think my dad, I mean, he's coached me. He's coached me in everything my whole life.
Uh-huh.
So I think he's kind of taught me a lot, and just kind of, he's taught me how to kind of be a leader and how to embrace your role. And he's just taught me a lot of different life lessons that, I've been with him my whole life, and he's always been a coach, and he's always been super hard on me and my brother. And, I think it's helped me get to where I am today, and it's just kind of shaped me overall. It's kind of hard to pick out one thing that he's done for me, because he's done so much, and just shown so much dedication to just helping me and my brother become better. A couple of players that I really look up to, it's kind of funny, because when I was a fourth grader, I played with Ben Reeves back at Pittsburgh.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, so he was on my team, and how he was in college, he was just like that, except even more dominant. And so I always kind of looked up to him, and he always kind of took me under his wing a little bit back then. And then it was kind of funny to come circle, and now he's still on campus, so I see him all the time. So he's always someone I've kind of looked up to, just because he always kind of had that spotlight on him from a young age, and he always just handled it with so much class and never was arrogant. And then I think going back to Albany, Connor Fields really showed me a lot, took me under his wing, and he was always an undersized kid, not the most athletic, and he just showed me really how hard work can go a long way. So I still keep in touch with him all the time, and he always keeps me level-headed. He's sure to let me know I'm still a terrible shooter. So I owe a lot to him, too.
All right, it's a big weekend for the Erland family. Your brother Chase has worked his way into the starting goalkeeper job at Cornell in his freshman year. What's it going to be like playing against your brother for the first time?
It's going to be something else. I think he's one of the best goalies I've ever played with. It might sound a little biased, but I mean he's pretty good. So we got to bring it. It's going to be weird. I don't know. I'm trying to just stay focused on the game, but I know as soon as I see him, it's gonna be weird, and I'm gonna try to have to keep it in check, and so is he. But I mean, it's gonna be hard not to cheer for him, but you kind of have to cheer against him because if he's doing well, that means we're probably not scoring very much. So I'm excited for it. Obviously, a little nervous.
How are your parents holding up? How are your parents holding up? Are they going to, like, have they decided where they're going to sit, or are they going to, like, one wear red, one wear blue kind of thing?
I think they're going to be as undercover as possible. they put me in a tough position to phase with me to win all this stuff because that doesn't bode well for my team. but I'm hoping they cheer for me. Who knows? He's a favorite child, so we'll see.
All right, last question. Dixie and I talk about food a lot on this podcast, as you probably know. And a few weeks ago, somehow New Haven Pizza came up. So I have a niece and a nephew who graduated from Yale. My nephew just graduated a year ago. And I got his recommendations. But I want to know from you, who's got the best pizza in New Haven?
I have to go with Sally's. We went in the fall, and it was a couple kids. It was me, Lucas Kotler, Will Sullivan, Sam Salati, and Jackson Morrill, and that was some of the best pizza I've ever had. And there were so many different varieties, and so I got to go with Sally's. That was pretty unbelievable.
Have you ever tried Pepe's? That was his other recommendation. He's like, there's two that are like famous, Sally's and Pepe's. And then he said, there's a place called Modern. That's his favorite. And then
Modern is very good, very underrated.
Yeah, he said that's his favorite. And then he said his house was across the street from some place called Brick Oven Pizza.
Yeah, and he said Brick Oven is very good.
Yeah, he said he's got a soft spot for that place because he's probably had like hundreds of slices from there. But he said Modern's his favorite. You should go check it out.
Yeah, that's a good late night place. That's they're open, I think, 24/7. So that's a really good Brick Oven's good. That's kind of the sleeper pick. Modern's good as well. So I think that might be my sleeper pick, though.
I love it. All right, TD, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck this Saturday throughout the season, and we hope to have you on again sometime soon. Thanks, TD.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right, Dex, time for the give and go.
Okay.
All right. You know what this weekend is, right? Besides some hot lacrosse action. It's St. Patrick's Day, Dix.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Aaron Gabrot. Shame on me.
Yes.
Were you at the parade last weekend in Baltimore?
Was it last weekend? Why wouldn't they have it this weekend?
I don't know.
It should be this weekend. St. Patrick's Day is the 17th. It's on Sunday. I think for a lot of people, the whole weekend is going to be centered around this event, at least for some people in my house. So my question for you, Dix, is what are your three favorite things about, or your just your favorite things about St. Patrick's Day?
I'm not Irish. But everybody is Irish, I guess, on St. Patrick's Day. Beer. Like beer. Not necessarily green beer, but I will.
Sit around with Tobes and Squee and have beer.
Tobes and Squee.
You sound like Brett Kavanaugh when you're like, I like beer. Beer. Like beer.
Gotcha. Oh, boy.
Some skis.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. I do like beer. Corned beef and cabbage is always something that's that you don't get every day. So if you can get your hands on some corned beef and cabbage, it's really, really good. And gosh, what else? St. Patrick's Day. I don't necessarily go out of my way to wear anything green. I don't really have anything green in my life in terms of, you know, like organizations I support, uh-huh, or teams I support or something like that. I'm struggling. Beer and the food is good.
Good enough. It's good enough.
I mean, I guess maybe also St. Patrick's Day is typically conference tournament weekend for basketball. That's a pretty good one.
In a way, it's sort of like the beginning of spring in Baltimore.
Yeah,
it's basketball tournament, the NCAA tournament. Selection Sunday will be on St. Patrick's Day.
This is your nerd time of the year.
I do love me some college basketball.
Yeah. Are you guys taking a trip this year for to watch the games?
No, I don't think so. one of the guys had his fourth kid.
Oh, wow.
And I think that sort of sidelined the
trip. That'll put a kibosh on that.
Yeah. But it's just a fun time here. So one of the things I like, you mentioned the corned beef and cabbage. Love it. I already got mine. It's 5.5 pounds of corned beef.
So you bought one?
Yeah, you got it. Where do you get yours? You got to cook it yourself.
I don't know. If I go to a restaurant.
So what's great about it is it's one of those things, like a Thanksgiving turkey, but this is like the easiest thing to cook. Mm-hmm. You just put it in a big pot of water with
you
some cabbage.
You set it and forget it.
Basically. Right? But it's so good. I don't know why we don't eat corned beef more in this way. You know, it is something that I make probably once a year.
My wife and I were watching Campus Eats, which is a show on the Big Ten Network.
I've definitely seen that.
One that they go to different Big Ten schools and their famous eateries. I forget where they were, but they were having a pastrami sandwich. And my wife and I, for whatever reason, got into a discussion around pastrami versus corned beef. She prefers pastrami. I prefer corned beef.
Corned beef's better.
So it's leaner.
Yeah. But I also like the cabbage, the potatoes, the carrots you put in there, the little onion. It's great. I love it. Love corned beef cabbage.
You got a whole thing going.
I don't know whether I'm going to make it on Saturday or Sunday. Can't decide.
Big weekend.
Other thing I like the music.
Okay.
I like Irish music, but in moderation.
U2.
I do love U2.
U2. And who else is in Irish? The Cranberries. Mm-hmm. Irish, right?
There's other ones, I'm sure.
Big Country is not Irish. Remember Big Country? In a big country, dreams will stay
Brian
with
Reeves.
You.
No. Big Country is center for Oklahoma State.
But a lot of people think that the band Big Country from the 80s, a lot of people call them a one-hit wonder. They actually had like two or three hits.
Mm-hmm.
Fields of Fire was another one. But they're Scottish. They're not Irish. They're Scottish. What other Irish
bands?
But,
you know, the bagpipes and the, I think like the...
Oh, you're not talking about rock. You're not talking about Bono. You're talking about...
I mean like Celtic music. Yeah. The Irish dancing type of music, which I like, but again, in moderation. Just like corned beef and cabbage, just like, you know, a lot of other things. It's like, it's good for a weekend, a couple days, but I don't need to hear that all the time.
Okay.
And then the last thing, you mentioned this, that everybody feels like they're Irish on St. Patrick's Day.
Right.
Which I just think is hilarious. So I've told you, I have an au pair who lives in our house.
Yes.
She's from Germany. She takes care of my two kids. She's 22 years old.
So she likes the Scorpions.
I think that's way before her time.
But they're German.
I've mentioned. Oh yeah, yeah. Scorp's one of my favorite bands.
Who else is German from in the music world?
David Hasselhoff.
He's not German, is he? He's just a hit.
He's very
Germany.
Popular there.
Okay.
No, but I was. She's telling me that.
You know who's German is After the Fire, Der Kommissar. Remember the song Der Kommissar? Yes. I think they're German. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So she hangs out at the Loonies in Maple Lawn.
Yeah.
That's like where au pairs go.
It's where I watched the Reagan years.
Yeah.
My favorite 80s tribute band.
I bumped
band.
Into you there before watching the 80s bands. But
So wait a minute. Loonies is like an au pair hangout?
Yes, it is. So where Howard County au pairs hang out.
So it's a hangout for au pairs and dirty old men.
Yeah. And there could be a connection there.
Okay.
I love how you just told everyone that you hang out there all the time.
That is not true.
Anyway,
but I did it for I go for the Reagan years. I don't go for au pair night.
Au pair nights every night there. Yeah. Anyway, she's from Germany, and was talking to me earlier this week about how she's a little worried that since St. Patrick's Day falls on a Sunday, you know, she has to work on Monday morning, you know, bright and early, take care of my kids, get my daughter off to school. But she was a little, you know, concerned that, you know, she may have to tone it all back a little bit on Sunday. And I said, because also one of her favorite bands is supposed to play St. Patrick's Day weekend. And then I said, wait a second. What do they celebrate St. Patrick's Day in Germany? And she said, no, I never heard of it before I came to America last year. What do you even care? Like,
when in Rome.
Exactly. And that's the point that she thought that, you know, it's just what you do. If you live in America, you go out on St. Patrick's Day and all your friends are going out. It's the biggest, one of the biggest drinking festivals, fun days of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love that someone who is a German citizen who can't wait to celebrate all things Irish on Sunday this week. So.
So did you tell your wife or not that she's going to be majorly hungover on Monday morning when she comes to take care of the kids?
I didn't. I think Amy will see that for herself. But anyway, I love that aspect of it. So cool. You know, the food, the music, and then everybody's in a good mood. It's like one of those days where everybody's happy and celebrating, even when they probably shouldn't. So that's our show for this week. If you like what you heard, please do us a favor. Click on the subscribe button, leave a rating, and share it with a friend. You can hit us up on Twitter. He's at Dixon Lacrosse, and I'm at D_Fly. That's D_FLY. Or you can hit me with an email at dflynn@insidelacrosse.com. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts here at Inside Lacrosse. A new one drops every weekday during the season. Have a great weekend, and enjoy the games.